welcome to episode 47 of the Island CT podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast. Oh, this is going to be dangerous. I keep hitting this thing. Okay, we're having lots of audio problems here. So hopefully we can make it through this.
Right. We're recording on June 14th, 2017.
Okay. Still running.
It's still running, so we will continue.
So, yeah, we're like more than 2 weeks late.
Right.
So it's on to the next podcast time, but we had just a crazy time. Well, with the end of the ARDF season and the school year.
Yes. So. Yeah, at the end of the school year, everything gets kind of crazy. And I have to say I was unable to keep up with many things.
Yeah, same here. But we, I mean, we should be able to. It's just, I don't know, stuff was happening. Mm. Do articles first, because when we talk about that, we'll be talking about what we're doing next also.
Okay. How about we start with saving the giant Weta?
Okay.
Okay. Just going to pull up the article.
Yeah, we're a bit slow.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this huge insect in New Zealand, and they've just started to make a comeback with help from conservationists, and it is like a monster of an insect. It is the size of a mouse, and so it's hard for me to...
So this is a news piece of Science, June 9th, okay.
2017.
Do you want me to go on about it?
Sure.
Okay, so, I mean, there's many Weta bugs, but yes. I think the idea is, the background is, what, 65 million years ago? The asteroid hits the planet Earth, dinosaurs disappear, and suddenly mammals start to fill in the niche, and you have this huge expansion in species for mammals and conquering territory. But New Zealand separated from other land masses, they said 15 million years before that, so that's what, 80 million years ago? And there were no mammals in New Zealand.
Right.
And so there's all sorts of insects that started to grow to fill in the niches, I suppose, that were there because of dinosaurs. Maybe not. Maybe it's that the dinosaurs disappeared, and now they weren't being predated on, and niches that were not taken by dinosaurs or mammals, they got to fill. So you got all different kinds. And I don't know if, probably not just Weta bugs, but this article is specifically about the Weta. And what's it called? The Maho something? Let me look for it. Maho Nui?
Yes.
No.
It is. No, it's part the Maho Nui.
Mahoe Nui.
Yeah.
Mahoe Nui giant Weta.
Weta.
Yeah. So that's one of the Weta bugs.
Right.
But they have like all different niches they filled. Some have like huge jumping powers. Some come out only at night. Some have these tusks.
Right, and the main point was because of the absence of mammals and predators, you have strange things happen on New Zealand that didn't happen in other places, like flightless birds.
Right, the kiwi.
You know,
That one parrot, do you remember what it's called?
No, I don't.
Anyway, and then, so to fill in the background, 800 years ago, Polynesians showed up and they brought some kind of a rat with it. So that was a problem because right away the rats had a had a feast.
Right.
And then a lot later, West Europeans showed up with
right.
the Norway
with tree
rat.
Climbing and, ship rats.
Yeah. So, yeah, so a lot of these species have gone downhill, and I don't know, maybe a lot of them disappeared. I'm not sure if
right.
we even know. You didn't mention that possibility, but anyway, so,
right.
yeah.
And then they make another point that it's an invasive plant in New Zealand mm. that actually protected the weta and helped spur the comeback.
That might be one of my favorite stories. Mm-hmm. So where is this?
It's
on the Northern Island.
Yeah.
And they thought they...
Yeah, it's the Northern Island pastures.
And they thought they were totally gone from the Northern Island, right? I think.
Yeah, and it's a grouse, a thorny yellow-flowered bush that spreads wildly after being introduced. It causes a hedgerow plant.
Are you on the right side, right column there
yeah.
somewhere?
Right column.
So, gorse.
Gorse, sorry.
Yeah.
Gorse, my
yeah, so
mistake.
That, so the gorse is an invasive
yeah,
plant also.
It is.
Like an invasive species.
Yeah.
And then, but what I like about it is the fact that the gorse by itself is not going to protect the giant weta.
No.
But the fact that goats are the only animal that are willing to eat this thing, and in response, I think, I'm reading behind the lines
yes.
maybe, I'm not sure, the gorse grows unbelievably thick wherever the goats browse it.
Right, right.
And then not even mice can get in there.
Right.
And did you look down
yeah.
and see the picture?
It even says too dense and thorny for predators, mammals to get in, and it allowed a refuge yeah. for the weta.
So that's, they have an awesome picture of
yeah.
A Mahoe Nui giant weta on gorse, and it just looks like spines.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And it's because of the insect's exoskeleton that allows it to live there, where mammals
yeah.
and softer
right.
tissued organisms can't
yeah.
live.
Yeah, so they discovered it, did they say when? It was 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's a while ago. Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, became an official preserve and so on, and they were still going. Like in the mid-2000s, they said they still had three of these populations of the Mahoe Nui.
Mm-hmm.
One in the gorse patch,
mm-hmm.
one on a special reserve, and a lot of this article was about a special reserve someone set up. It's a fenced-in area for native species like the kiwi, and it's like works really well except for the insects, because the insects keep escaping. And then another is a lot of, not just the giant Mahoe Nui weta, but others also they've established mm-hmm. on islands that are rodent-free, some of
right.
them, I think, to begin with, and then other ones they put poison bait to get rid
right.
of mammals. But if I remember right, the one, so the giant weta, the Mahoe Nui one, it's in pretty serious trouble because the gorse patch has been invaded in the north where it was, has been
mm-hmm.
invaded by another species, and
right.
the numbers there have plummeted. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the same weta species, but I know one of the weta species is on an island that's rodent-free, but it's within range of swimming of the rodents
yeah.
from other islands where there are some. So that's mm-hmm. kind of a bummer. Anyway.
And there, you know, there's battling of climate change and that impacting the environment as well.
Sure, sure. Yeah. They had some interesting stats about how many species, I don't remember. I think it's like, they were saying something like, you know, we make lists of endangered insect species, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, what's done about it? It turns out that very little is done to protect the insects. So it's just like, well, so we have a list. Anyway, it's really cool
mm-hmm.
that they're doing this in New Zealand.
Yeah. I think it is. And it's just not being done worldwide.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you think about it, and especially with our article from last time out of Germany talking about the decline in insects.
Yeah, yeah.
It was interesting that,
this one came
back and people are starting to be more mindful.
Is this turning into another insect podcast? What is wrong with us?
I know.
This is going to be... Is there an entomology podcast out there? Anyway. Okay. Call it for the giant meta.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really cool article.
It was.
Definitely worth checking out. Do you remember? I just closed the article, so I won't find it. But there was this one guy talking about comparing how people react to it. And the fact that, you get kids in schools and you show it to them like when they're really, really young and they're like, wow, this is like amazing, right? They see these giant weta. And then he says, and then they turn to 13-year-old, sometime around when they turn 13-year-old, suddenly their instant reaction, instead of just being like, this is amazing and cool, it turns into, ew, disgusting.
I know, I can't find it, but yeah. I remember that from the article.
I thought it was fun.
That was.
Okay, we have... Let's go ahead and enumerate everything we have. It's kind of fun to know ahead of time.
I think.
I like when podcasts do that. So we have something about transgenic orange petunias. That's really fun.
Yeah.
And we have a mine... So it's research being done in a bunch of places, but there's this special chance to do it in a gold mine in South Africa. It has to do with earthquakes.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. You're going to carry most of that one?
Because
I didn't get a chance since I read it the first time to review it.
And bat nose fungus.
Bat nose fungus, which will be a local thing, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Local to North Carolina, where we are. And then I have one you haven't seen at all, which has to do with selfish genes and a discovery done in C. elegans.
Nice.
And I think that's all we're going to cover. And then we'll do what we've been doing and our busy time.
Right.
And,
okay. That sounds
so
perfect.
So which one do you want to pick?
I thought we could go for the bat nose fungus.
Okay. So, did you get any of that at all?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
So, this came in, I don't know, I keep getting these emails from the North Carolina Wildlife Service. I think a while back when we were into fishing with the kids.
Yeah.
That
You got put on a list?
I got put on a list, or I signed up for it maybe, I don't know. And so, I checked this one out, and it was a news piece. It was really interesting. So, well, the bats are really interesting. It got me looking at bats. I guess there's this huge movement to make bat houses, and I'm not going to talk about it, but it's been like totally figured out. There's books you can get, and it's like there's a right way to do it, and there's still a lot of research being done by just people that like bats, right? Mm-hmm. This is not scientists. But the success rates now for creating bat houses has really gone up.
Right.
Because there's some principles we understand better.
So there's big concern about the bat population.
Yeah, so this was a news piece from on the North Carolina Wildlife Service website, and they were just putting out this notice that white nose syndrome, WNS, it's a fungal infection.
Right.
Bats show up with fungus on their noses, their heads, their wings.
Yeah.
and go ahead.
And the fungus only lives in a small temperature gradient. So it lives from 45 degrees to 55 degrees.
Fahrenheit.
And so the caves and wet, moist environments of that temperature make a great atmosphere.
Yeah, and only in high humidity.
Or habitat.
Yeah.
And North Carolina definitely has high humidity.
Yeah. Well, it's only in the caves, and there's not many caves in the coastal plain. So you're talking about the mountains.
Right.
But I guess this disease is just going across the United States.
Yeah. Which makes me think there's a lot of communication between different groups of bats.
Yeah.
Like it can't be transmitted unless there was some kind of...
Right. They say it's transmitted bat to bat, possibly person to person. I mean, not people, but one person
bringing
it from one cave to another, not the person getting the disease. And
one they say it doesn't individual to the other.
Yeah, they say it doesn't affect people at all, but, you know, you get spores on your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
They mentioned Linville Caverns, I think it's called, is the only commercial site in North Carolina that has a cave.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making people that visit their place put their feet through a disinfectant.
Oh, yeah.
So they're really serious about it. So the story is WNS was first found in the North Carolina mountains in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found it actually east of the mountains. So in the mountains, the bats have been hit really hard, but they're only those species that live in caves. And of mm-hmm. those, there's four that get hit really hard. And then the other ones are okay. I can't remember which four species. Oh, there we go. Have it here.
Yep.
Northern long-eared.
Them. Yep.
Little brown, tricolored, and Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the four that have been hit really bad. And then there's also bats. I mean, this sounds really wild to me, but they don't roost in caves. And they don't roost in colonies. They roost individually.
Yeah.
And some of them even stay over winter. So, and they just go in trees. I'm like, wow.
That is really crazy.
Anyway, so they're totally free. There was one place they found WNS in one bat, I think it was, in the east of the mountains. And then they went back and checked later, and it had disappeared. But then they found it in another one even further east. So that's kind of a bummer.
Like, since it's a fungus, you kind of wonder, wow, is it something with their diet that's changed that made them more susceptible? Like, you know?
Yeah, is it something, well, except or it's moving across the states.
Yeah.
It could be a countrywide if it's climactic, right? Mm-hmm. But, I don't know. The other possibility is it's a change in the fungus.
Right.
The fungus mutated or something. Or it's an introduction of the fungus to the species from somewhere
else. From another species, yeah. That's true.
Or to caves, to that mm-hmm. look. Like maybe it wasn't in caves before.
Mm-hmm.
And so. Anyway, so, but it got me reading all sorts of stuff about bats, and it's just very cool. I want to make a bat house sometime. So. Anyway. I think that's it for bats, though.
Great.
I
thought it was good.
The other stuff I read.
So the article I read was actually out of Pennsylvania with the students, where they were hit.
Oh.
By.
Cool.
White nose fungus.
Fungus.
Yeah. So definitely traveling down through the United States. Okay. So I think you could go with your selfish gene.
So that's going to be super short.
Yeah.
So this was in the latest science, June 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in, it's, so there, so I only read the perspective, but there's actually an article in Science, mm-hmm. a research article. And I only saw this today. That's why I haven't gotten to the article yet. And these people were researching some genetic question using kind of Chironomidus elegans, as you do. And they kept making these crosses, and they were trying to, I can't remember exactly what they were doing, but they were trying to, they were basically crossing two strains of C. elegans, the Bristol strain and the Hawaiian strain, or the Hawaii strain. And they were trying to get this one particular gene when they had it combined to both, and they didn't want this separate region to be part of the new strain.
Right.
And this new, this in particular, chromosome 3, they didn't want it to be from the Bristol strain, along with a bunch of other things. And no matter how much they crossed it, chromosome 3 was always from the Bristol strain. And they're like, what the hell is happening, right? Because the two worms mate. I mean, they are sexual. You get offspring. They should, if you're mating two different strains, then the offspring should have half from one animal and half from the other parent. And then their offspring should be 50-50.
Right.
From every part of the gene. And then you cull to be keeping the ones that you want. But the offspring always had the Bristol strain.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, okay, they did a bunch of narrowing down to exactly what it was, and they found these two genes, SUP35 and FA1. And SUP35 is a poison. It's a gene for a poison.
Hmm.
And if I remember correctly, the mother makes the poison and poisons her own eggs. So the SUP35 genes makes a poison that the mother makes and puts onto her own eggs. The eggs have the SUP35 genes, but that doesn't matter because it's the mother that's creating the poison. But they have the FA1 gene, which is right next to the SUP35 gene on chromosome 3, or close to it, mm-hmm. I think. And the FA1 gene is the antidote, makes the antidote.
Oh.
And the FA1 gene is transcribed in the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it destroys the eggs, but I think it's part of pharynx development in the worm. So if you have SUP35, the pharynx doesn't develop correctly and they die.
Mm-hmm.
So every single offspring that you've mated between a Bristol and any other strain that doesn't have both FA1 and SUP35, every single offspring ends up, you know, with sexual crosses during meiosis with the Bristol strain only by the time you get to the
Got
one
it.
Generation down, because all the offspring of the F1 is a mix, of course, right? But then the next generation, the offspring die unless they have
right.
both the antidote. And because the two genes are close to each other, you're very unlikely to separate them out.
Mm-hmm.
So you need them both. And basically, the one thing that's really amazing about this as a possibility is that this is the second time something like this has been found only, but we're not looking for it. And let me see, is it the FA1? Yeah, FA1, we already knew about the gene.
Wow.
And we knew, and it was labeled as being absolutely essential. You know, it's lethal if you don't have it.
Right.
Why? Because the pharynx doesn't develop and the worm dies, right? But actually, it's not. It's only when you're studying the Bristol strain. And some other strains that have gotten this, right? Because it's the antidote to the poison,
right.
SUP35, which is closely linked to it. So people didn't realize. And so now they're thinking, holy smokes, maybe these gene pairs poison antidote? That's like a selfish gene.
Right.
It hurts the species to carry this, but it's forcing itself to be carried by putting the two together.
Right.
Maybe we've got a lot more of these than we think.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some of them are labeled essential because we don't realize it's just an antidote for something else.
Right, right, right.
So, here's the really big, awesome step. Imagine you get more and more of these selfish genes. You know, one, okay, so you live with it. They start to accumulate. And they accumulate in populations that are close to each other, but not, you know, super close. And then you start to have mating. And Now, imagine you had in the Hawaii nematodes a different set that was like sub-35 and FLA1. What are the chances you get exactly the right pair when you meet them together? You need to have both the Bristol on the one chromosome and that other one on the Hawaii.
Right.
You're going to have a lot of offspring die if a Bristol mates with a Hawaii then. But if they mate among themselves, they'll be fine. Both parents right. have the thing because that gene took over that population. It just can't take over the other one because, let's say, they're both on chromosome 3. So if you have the Bristol, you die because you're missing the Hawaii.
Got it.
But if you have the Hawaii, you die because you're missing the Bristol or something like that. So this is maybe one of the big reasons for speciations. Because if you have two populations and they start to have a selfish gene that starts to propagate, when it finally reaches the whole population, anytime those two populations try to breed, the offspring die.
God.
And then, you know, 10,000 years later, or in case of insects, 5 years later, they're different species.
I mean, right.
More than that for insects. I'm making a joke there. But the point is, this could be a huge driver of speciation that we don't even realize is around.
How crazy is
yeah.
that? That's really cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so I thought it was pretty amazing.
The reason I had you go to that one is because I thought that one was a nice segue into Strange Case of Orange Petunias.
That one was awesome.
Yes, it really was.
So let's see, this one, petunias.
So I will tell you where it's from. So it is from May 26, 2017, from The Science. And it is a biotechnology regulation article in News In Depth.
Yeah. So it's a news piece.
Yep. So pretty crazy article.
Or do you want to start it off?
I'll start it off. Okay. So this man notices these orange petunias.
In Helsinki.
In Helsinki.
At a train station.
At a train station.
Just happens to be taking the train.
Right. And he was thinking, wow.
These are really orange.
These are really orange. Huh. I wonder if they have foreign DNA. And so he takes a stem.
Or a whole clipping.
A whole clipping.
Stuffed it in his backpack when no one was watching.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to say the guy was a geneticist, right?
Yes.
And he'd heard... It was, he had an inkling, because he'd heard about a gene from maize put into flowers.
Right.
Like 30 years back or something.
Right. 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 And there was an article that he read about it.
He'd read articles about it. Yeah. And but he knew that it never made it to market. Or he was pretty sure.
It never, it was never in the market, never in the marketplace.
Oh, we didn't say, sorry. The question was, is this genetic engineering?
Right.
Because the articles he'd read about had used a maize gene to introduce color into flowers through a very old genetic engineering technique.
Right.
Not through plant breeding like breeders do.
Mm-hmm. And because they're using an older technique, he was able to actually see the modification at that DNA level.
So what's the,
where if they had used CRISPR, he wouldn't have been able to identify specific location.
I have that under my cauliflower mosaic virus.
Yeah.
Has a promoter.
Yeah.
That's been, I mean, it was studied for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early days of genetic engineering, that promoter was used all over the place in studying genetically engineered plants. And so now, and there's only a few that were used.
Right.
So of the older research, you can identify plants that have been genetically engineered because you look for those promoters. But yeah. Anyway, so what happened?
So he finds out that this is actually created using biotechnology, an older technique, like you mentioned, and So he reports it.
Well, I think it's not like, hey, I mean, didn't he like meet up with an old PhD student?
Right.
That, and was like, hey, did you know that blah, 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 blah. And it turns out that PhD student happens to be working for the Helsinki Board of something or
Food
other.
Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah. I don't know. It's some Finnish.
I'll look it up while you were talking.
Gene technology institution. And but it's a regulatory agency.
Yes, it is.
And so the guy went back to his bosses and stuff, and they said, whoa, this is illegal. You're not allowed to sell these, and so these are being banned.
They just say a regulatory agency in the United States and
No. This is much earlier.
Okay.
Let's see. Here it is. Former PhD student taking a job as a regulator at Finnish Board of Gene Technology. That was the first spot.
Okay.
Right? That was the first. And so a little while later, Finland bans something or other, or says that sunflowers have to be removed from the market.
Right.
And then other agencies in Europe see that and are like, what are you doing? Is this a problem here? And so then they investigate, they do their own testing, and then they found, yeah, it's a problem here. And then you were talking about the FDA in the US. Mm-hmm. They hear about it from what's happening in the news, just from what's happening in Europe. And they're like, I mean, the FDA actually doesn't care. It was, it's a small part of the FDA.
Right.
And they're tasking regulating food safety or something.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, because the mosaic virus, that cauliflower mosaic virus, is a pest, anything that shows up with that DNA in it, they get to regulate and they have to take it in the market. Now, this has nothing to do with the pest infestation, but it's the law, right? And the law was written by Congress, I guess, at a time when this was never envisioned as a possibility, that this pest DNA would show up in...
And there was a fear about transgenic and them being synonymous with toxic. And so no one wanted it.
Yeah. Or in Europe, maybe.
And in the United States at the beginning.
I don't think at the time it was even an issue. Like, this law was not written having to do with genetic engineering.
No.
This law was written... Basically, they don't care about... That agency cares nothing about flowers.
No.
Right? It's part of the FDA, and their sole task is to make sure that the food is safe, and their particular narrow look is these plant pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
And someone made a list saying, you know, these pieces of DNA, if you find them in plants, then you have to remove them off the market or something or other. And the cauliflower mosaic virus DNA shows up there. And the law is written that if a plant has it, it falls under your jurisdiction, even though they're not tasked with regulating flowers, just edible food, right? And so according to the law, and the law, I guess, has been rewritten already, so that's not an issue, but it's not the new bill isn't been passed into law yet. And the law is what it is, and they don't have a choice. As regulators, they have to. So, yeah, we got like millions of dollars being lost or something. I don't know. So, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. And I like the what they decided, though, because this being an isolated case, or what they observed as an isolated case, and there was no... it was not intended to happen this way.
Yeah.
That there will not be any charges associated with the company.
Which is good.
Which I think is important.
Although I think their idea that this is an isolated case does not it doesn't rhyme at all with a description of how it happened. I mean, maybe they know better, but their description makes so much. So before I go on to that, by the way, I actually found it's not the FDA. I was just scanning while you were talking. It's the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's a part of it, and it's the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS. Mm-hmm. So if the USDA's little part called APHIS that had to handle this and cause recalls of all these flowers, destruction. But anyway, yeah, so this is how they describe. Now, how is this possible that these all these plants all over the place ended up genetically engineered when this gene was never marketed?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the history, people are forming companies and then folding them continuously with, like, they have an idea. Oh, wow. We came up with, let's make this company. And then they apply for and for doing some tests and stuff. And like you said, when they started, there was this, there's this term that they have in the article that at some point someone says, saying anything was transgenic was basically the same thing to the public as saying it was toxic.
Right.
And so these companies form, and then they fold, and the technology gets sold to another company that just got created to do it somewhere else in the world. Like, it got marketed, or it got an application in Florida, I think, at some point. It was bought by a company in the Netherlands, and then, I don't know, that company or some other one allowed them to do some tests in Florida. And it was going to go to the market, but then they decide not to. And the company was bought by someone else. And you can see, you got banks and banks of seeds someplace, right? Mm-hmm. And you transfer the company, and people get laid off, new people come over, they look at the list. We're going to have genetically engineered seeds and plants all over the place. The concept that some of it is not going to get mislabeled.
Right.
It's just not the way things happen. You know, especially since that was done 30 years ago, right?
Right.
You could have some of these seeds. You know, don't want to throw it out. There's a lot of work was put into it. So it's stored. Two companies later, someone looks at this, doesn't recognize the notation, and is like, hey, let's try all of these seeds crossed with this to see if it works. Suddenly you got orange flowers. Cool, right?
Right.
Put them on the market. Okay. And then the other thing I said is, how come you end up with companies all over the world selling these orange petunias? Well, it's not just that the companies form and get destroyed and then sell their seeds to a bunch of people. It's that these companies are constantly going over to competitors' plants, taking clippings and mixing it with theirs to see if they can't outdo them.
Right.
So it might not even be transfer within a company.
Exactly. Right? It's just a matter of purchasing different plants and seeing what you can come up with the crosses
You
can.
He was saying no one was thinking when they do a clipping, ooh, we better check for genetic markers for genetic engineering, because it wasn't even a thought, right? But then what you said about the comparison between the cauliflower mosaic and that type of technology and CRISPR, that really comes in, right? Because, yeah, maybe now companies will make sure to check, right? But who's going to use these old technology? It's all going to be CRISPR-like technology.
Exactly.
And then how do you know that it's been genetically engineered? You'd have to really look at that specific place that the person, you know, introduced a gene to know, or of a particular kind of gene, and expect it to not be there. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, in a way, I feel bad about how this is going, and I don't wish it on the world, but I don't know. I'm not certain there's a way to stop it.
Right.
So.
Right. No, anyway. I agree. But very interesting. But it was a article.
funny.
Yeah, right? because it's just like one of these things. Like, he clips the plant and takes it with him because
then a serendipitous meeting with a student that just happens to be working for the Finnish board of Finnish board for gene technology.
Yeah.
Do you still have two articles up? I only have one.
I just have one now. So the other article that I came across, actually Patrick came across it and shared it with me, and it's from Science, and it is from June 12th.
Nope, May 26th.
No, June 12th.
That's when that copy got downloaded.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's from the same Science as the Petunias article.
Oh, okay. Yeah, pardon me. It still says June 2nd. No, it's June 2nd issue, 2017.
Really?
And it's an in-depth article from News, and it's seismology. And these Japanese scientists are going into gold mines.
Oh, no.
In...
I have this mislabeled.
In Africa. And they've been doing this in South Africa since after apartheid. And I think what intrigued me most about the article is that they're going into these very deep mines in order to find new fault areas to study microbes. And I never knew that gold mines were 2 to 3 kilometers deep. That just blew my mind.
Well, no, this is the deepest one in the Earth.
Oh, okay.
On Earth.
Because I was like, whoa, I had no idea. Anyway,
yeah.
But it's just their luck that they had new earthquake activity around one of the mines that they were in the Moab Kotsong area, and
Moab Kotsong mine.
Mine, pardon me.
Yeah.
And it actually produced a new fault, and in that fault they have higher levels of hydrogen, and that would be the perfect conditions for these microbes to live in, because they're...
I didn't remember that.
I'm
sure that's right.
Anyway, and...
I mean, that's the case in all faults.
Right. And this is... they make a point that, you know, since they're living on the hydrogen gas, that this is a good crossover for the Mars mission to NASA.
Yeah. So I think maybe a little bit of background.
Okay.
There's interest on the side of geologists, nothing to do with microbes, and that's the much bigger
thing.
And it has to do with what's happening during earthquakes, right at that place. That's, you know, an earthquake is usually caused by two plates that are against each other, or two
transform boundary.
What did you call it?
A transform boundary.
A transform boundary. So I didn't know the term, but these two land masses at the transform boundary, and
are slipping past.
They're slipping past each other, but they've caught up, and then suddenly there's a spot that gives way and breaks, and they move.
Right.
And we've never had a chance to drill down to exactly that spot, because those are very deep,
very
in the
deep
earth,
in the earth.
Right? But there's been attempts to get close.
Yeah.
And this mine in South Africa is the deepest mine in the world, supposedly 3 kilometers. And was it last year? It's been a while since I looked at this article. I don't remember.
I think it is last year.
Anyway, recently there was an earthquake there, and there'd never been an earthquake there, and they found out that that center of the fault is directly below the mine.
Right.
And even in those places, like some places we can get to them because those places where it's suddenly the fault breaks or gives way.
Also, this is a new fault that formed.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that's
so huge. There's two things. There's ones close to the surface, and those we can get to.
Right.
But they're smaller, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been moving for a long time.
Right.
Because faults keep moving. So if you have a fault, it's probably been there for millions of years. And like you said, the big deal for this one is not just that we can get to the center, but it's brand new. Mm-hmm. There's never been an earthquake there that we know of. There might have only been 2 to 3. And after the stuff's been slipping for a while, there's a name for just rubble that accumulates. Rubble is not the right word. But, you know, from just the grinding in the two pieces of earth together. And so these Japanese researchers that were in South Africa, they were already looking down into faults. Ooh, that's my mouse.
Oh.
and so that's the background. Is they were looking for stuff there. That earthquake happened. It's a brand new earthquake. It's a deep earthquake. And it's directly below this mine. So they can get to it by drilling just another 700 meters or so. Or get close to it anyway.
Right.
Which there is this cool thing about the microbes also that's really cool to that area of science.
Right.
But that's the big push is trying to understand better how earthquakes happen.
Right.
In fault zones.
So there's some cool stuff happening in around that whole working in mines and discovering new faults and being able to study new faults for the first time. So very nice, great article. And it'll be neat to hear more about what they find.
Yeah.
Because it may not be immediate. It may be, you know, several years from now.
Yeah. Because
when something moves.
I was about to say, they still haven't started drilling yet.
Right. So. Right.
Anyway.
Okay.
That is all the articles. Can I just honorably mention, I had really wanted to talk about... there's a whole push to have sub-millimeter telescopes being built because they've gotten a lot cheaper because of technology. And so this time it is the May 26th issue. There was a news story called Lofty Telescope Will Survey Cool Universe, and it's up in the Atacama Desert. There's already a big telescope array. But it's in order to have an array, you need an absolutely flat area. So it's one of those huge plateaus way, way high up. I think the highest plateau on Earth, except for Tibet, maybe. And they're thinking of building a single telescope on a peak close to it, which would have a much wider field of view. So it wouldn't be as good of a telescope in terms of how precise it is, but it could see large areas. Or maybe it's the other way around. I can't remember. But it was a really cool article. Definitely worth checking out.
Neat.
And so seeing the pictures makes me want to visit the place.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, I think that's all of our science.
Okay.
So what's happened since the last one? It's been forever. Let me see.
Oh, there's been a lot of things. So we had another ARTIF competition or event on June 3rd.
We recorded the last podcast on May 18th.
Ooh, so there were two.
So the first thing was there was an O-meet at Olmsted South. But we didn't go to that one, did we?
No, we did not.
Okay. And then the weekend after that, Isaac came to visit. That was cool. And we had our extra ARDF event. So that was the last one for the school of the year.
So we finished up that one. And
what was special about that one?
We had a lot of people show up that we didn't anticipate. We only expected 5.
That's right.
And we got maybe 13 or so people.
Yeah.
Including adults. And it was really nice to see. Cause
that was not the birth... Was that the birthday party one?
No.
No.
That was the one after. And it was just a really nice outing, and it was so unexpected how many people showed up. So, very nice way to end the ARTIF season for the schools. And I think Charles had a great idea about having, you know, some kind of trophies with certain goals to reach to achieve them.
Yeah.
For the next art of season, and we'll have to think of that and see how to incorporate that. Because I do think that we could do it now, since we have people that are going to be coming out, and it'll give them an extra challenge and something to work towards. Yep. The other thing, June 3rd, we had our last BOK event.
BRDF.
And that was crazy.
That was hectic.
But it was good.
We basically lost control on that one.
Oh, we did.
We were too many people. We couldn't keep up. So
that being said, I think we did pretty good considering everything that happened.
No, I think
we had transmitter number 2 just stop.
Stop working. Yep.
I grabbed Charles to go and fix it. And my solution choosing him was, you'll do a better job than I could.
Well, you were totally busy at the table.
I know. I'm trying to check people in, and I have people going, receiver or transmitter number 2 isn't working, and they keep on repeating it to me, and so I'm like, okay.
I was busy with the class, with all these people.
So we had a quick plan. We had a transmitter to replace it. Patrick quickly changed the switches, and Charles was good enough to run out.
Did I change the switch?
Yes, you did.
I don't remember.
And Charles was good enough to run out and take it on, which was very stressful for him because
it wasn't even on the air.
No, it wasn't on
the
air.
So he had to find it from the map, which in theory marks where it is, but you know, when I'm putting it,
if there's something cooler close by,
then I put it there, and I have to find the right size tree.
And also, you know, it's unexpected. And so when you grab someone and tell them, do it, it puts a little pressure on. Yeah. And I really appreciate did that.
Yeah. And, you know, it turned out in the end that the antenna had just pulled out.
Yeah.
And if you look at the setup he gave us, like he basically donated to our efforts, they all have strain release for the antenna. Mm-hmm. So he told us, this is a problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's just so much to do.
Right.
And I don't know when I'm going to get to fixing that on all the antennas. It's on the list of things to figure out.
Right.
So, but it's not as easy to think, because when you have that many to go through, I mean, I took everything off those antennas to make them smooth so they would come off the reel, because I am spending so much time at each spot, and that suddenly really sped up my time.
Right.
Sped up my course settings. So,
right.
You know, I'm leery about giving up
the speed.
The speed.
Yeah.
When I'm barely keeping up.
So, Patrick, to set a course, it takes him at least 2 to 3 hours, closer to 3 hours.
Like,
no, just wait.
Well, go ahead.
To set up just the antennas. Mm-hmm. And then it takes him another 2 hours to go out and place transmitters afterwards.
Right.
And so...
And do you know why? Why not before?
No.
The kids have been getting better.
Oh, yeah.
The course
has to be... So you have to go larger and larger.
I have to go larger.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it didn't used to be a problem.
No.
I could just go out. If I had 3 hours, I could do everything.
Yeah.
So the antennas, the flags, the our little tags that they collect, and then still help you set up and everything.
Right.
So, and I was doing that in the fall when it gets dark. Mm-hmm. Now it's the spring and I can't even do it.
And our BOK participants are also getting better. And although we had a bit of a fiasco in June on the June 3rd meet, We had a lot of people that showed up, and well, I hope they return.
So when you say they're getting better, that's the one thing that I feel the worst about, because we were so busy. What we didn't realize is they might be getting better, but their confidence after having not done for a bit got better way faster than their skills. And so they all just suddenly went out there and a lot of them couldn't find anything. No, and they came back after being out there for a really long time. And I feel so bad because it's like,
They didn't punch start again.
Some of them didn't punch start.
And so we had things. And honestly, it's something to be expected. You're handling a receiver for the first time and it's complicated and there's so much to think about. Yeah. And you're looking at your map and you're thinking of what you're going to do. And you're thinking immediately of finding your first one.
And your organizers are overworked, so they're not bothering to tell you how to do it. I mean, that was the bigger problem, right? Because BOK handles open events where there's tons of beginners all the time, and that's not an issue. The problem is no one was helping us, mm-hmm. right? And we just had just too much to do. And we had a lot of people shouting at us, and shouting that this wasn't working and whatnot.
Yeah.
And, we're going to need some help next year.
But the people that came and rented receivers, mm-hmm. they were very they were very patient.
They were all very nice.
And they were all very kind. I just want to point that out there. It wasn't like there's a screaming match.
Especially the people that, so here's the thing. We had also, for the very first time, I was excited to mm-hmm. use the BOK receivers.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get any of them to work.
Right.
And I think we could have. The thing is, they didn't show up until we were in the middle of everything. And the receivers that we have that are similar, we've worked at in the yard, made sure everything was going.
And I checked them as I'm putting them out in tables.
And yours were already all out in tables and checked. And the ones that aren't working or we are having a problem with are put back in the box. Mm-hmm. It's just too complicated.
Right.
We're going to do the BOK receivers, we have to have them in hand at the beginning of the season so
we can keep set up them with it and make sure that they're working and that.
Yeah.
Because, it's receivers for our...
Although, I have to say, if they're different, that suddenly makes it even more difficult also.
It does. Right? It does, because you don't have one standard model that you just explained
We spent 2 weeks trying to figure out what was wrong with our school ones, right?
Yeah.
And this was a real nightmare situation. It was in the winter. We knew we'd had problems in December, and we couldn't figure it out. Got some help from Charles. I had started to take... I basically took one apart.
Right.
And started to unsolder parts to figure out what the hell is happening, because none of them are working. And it was just a connection issue. But the thing is, once we had one figured out, then I had two tested. It's like, boom, okay, they're all done.
Right.
If you start to have all sorts of different receivers, that's going to take a lot more time if something doesn't work.
And
there is no way it's going to happen during the season.
No.
We have to have them in the beginning because
in
the middle, we were just barely, at the end, we weren't keeping up.
No.
And a lot of stuff slipped.
Yeah.
So.
And as we think of next year, I think we've learned a lot from the experience.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
And I think that we have a solid base for doing...
Oh, I think so.
...a very reliable event each time.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
And the thing is that we were caught off guard, right?
Yeah.
It's because the events had to get longer and I didn't realize how long I would be out, and suddenly there was more on you. Mm-hmm. And we'd never done the BOK events before. And it just suddenly put on more than we expected.
Right. And when we say more than we expected, that's a really positive thing. Because we really didn't expect to have
that many people
show up.
Well, that's
And that's why it was sort of like, what the heck?
That's awesome. The other thing. We were thinking maybe four or five people would show up instead of 18.
So when you know, you hear me being like, wow, and they were very patient and good with us considering, yeah. You know, it's just the numbers. And it was fantastic that we got those numbers. So I really hope that they feel confident enough to come back. And the last meet, oh, it was such a bummer too, because our temperature changed. And it's just something to note if you're putting on an event in the spring and you suddenly have very warm summer conditions, that you're going to have people that feel the heat and are being stressed by it because they're running courses out in the woods. And having water on hand and fruit and something for them to eat is, like, very important.
So I have to say, I said I was really bummed because all these people went out and couldn't find anything or just found one transmitter. Actually, we had a lot of people go on the red course, mm-hmm. and they did really well.
They
Most of them found everything.
Yeah.
And the difference is when you're even on the smaller courses, people were coming back pretty heated up.
Yeah, they
from
were.
From the temperature going up from the beginning of the morning to when people were getting back. But they're spending a lot of time trying to figure out why is this not working, right? Mm-hmm. The red people, they were pretty much going from one transmitter to another. Mm-hmm. And so they were on the move all the time, and they were covering a lot more distances.
Right. They were at least 5 kilometers running in the woods.
We had quite a few people come back quite overheated.
Right. And that's, I just, you know, I mentioned that now because I think, you know, if you're planning an event, take that into consideration. Because although we had it on hand, it was just supposed to be like, oh, look, you can have some water. We didn't think, like, you need a water here.
Right. We brought tons of water.
Drink the water.
Yeah. We brought tons of water, but it was mostly, like we always do, but it's mostly for the end when people get back.
It was more for people to hang out and have a water and a piece
of food. We've never had people push that hard during, well, the first BOK event, we had a couple.
Yeah.
But this time was, a lot of people went out and really
pushed hard. And they were pushing hard. Yeah. And it's exciting to see people who are just getting into it and get the excitement of it.
Yeah.
And we're still pleasantly surprised with people that come out and look like they probably won't be back. And they're just actually were excited and got it, but it took so much focus they had a serious face throughout.
And then that night we got home.
Oh, yeah.
And it was late. We'd picked up everything and we were just so exhausted. And I had signed up for the Omeet the next day.
Yeah.
And I knew that night, there's no way I'm making it. I was just, and I totally forgot to unsign up, which I should have done. And then I went to drop off the materials for Joseph that was doing the Eno. And I was trying to explain to him, you know, I can't make it. I didn't realize how much of a problem there was going to be in communicating, but I'm trying to tell you, I'm so sorry, I can't make it. You're like, no problem, you know, next time. Like, I felt bad about that. Anyway.
Yeah.
So was Sunday. The Eno one was Sunday. And then the very next day you had the field trip with your school.
230 some kids, 36 kids going to the White Water Center to do ropes course, whitewater rafting, and flatwater sports.
Yep.
So it was fun. And one of those trips that I always wish we could do, one at the beginning of the year and one at the end. But
so you saw something new there?
I did. Oh, it was fantastic. In fact, I came back and I told Pat, we needed to get a pool with a climbing wall. Because at the Whitewater Center, they have this climbing wall. And you go up and you climb on it. And then you just drop back into a pool. And although I thought I would be uncomfortable with it, I went through the intro and jumped on and did it. And I actually pushed myself because one of the girls wasn't going to do it. And I'm like, you just go and you do it. And it was fantastic. It was probably one of my favorite parts of the trip.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So let's see. So that was your whitewater thing. Now we have to find, a pool's not going to do it. It's going to have to be a house by a lake somewhere.
Yeah.
And then the weekend after school ended?
Yep.
So that's done?
Yep. Check, check.
And today's Wednesday after that. W9's, the release date is coming up on Saturday. I know you don't care, but I'm very excited. Then you're going to be in Ghana and to Canada for a week.
Mm-hmm. And then we're packing for Bear Island.
Then the weekend after that, well, July 4th weekend.
We have Isaac visiting.
Pack Bear Island, and Isaac mm-hmm. should be visiting.
Yep, so it'll be a good weekend.
Yep.
So, I think that kind of wraps it up.
I think that wraps it up. So, let me look at my notes here that you made up for me. Thank you. Yeah. So, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Oh, actually, this hasn't been anything in the blog.
That's true.
We haven't been able to keep up.
We will start doing our blog.
Make sure to check out the web pages. I do have a little bit of update.
Yeah, check out our pictures.
Pictures for the
Ardiff
meets mm-hmm. and the write-up is on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I did update a bit the course timing system and the 80-meter transmitter. Well, that's the other big plan. Is I need to work this summer at making 2-meter transmitters.
Right.
So I've started on that, kind of going slowly, mm-hmm. having problems. And the course timing system, we said, well, I'm still really excited for it, but the 2 meters got to come first. I think,
right.
you know, that's more important.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other, we have the system.
Right.
Okay, so re-wrap up. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Check out our blog.
Our webpage.
Our webpages.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.